Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday to defend and promote public education. And we have a press release for you today, 1047, How to Disappear a Problem. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jane. Press release 1047, How to Disappear a Problem. State Aid for Sectarian Schools. In a recent article entitled How to Disappear a Problem, the school system has spent 50 years not fixing one of its central flaws, published on Inside Story on the 10th of July 2025, Dean Ashenden, an honorary senior fellow at the University of Melbourne, tells the dismal story, starting with the Carmel Committee of 1973, of the increasing residualisation of public education, the growing sectarian basis of educational choice, and the concentrations of disadvantage within the public system. He concludes, Labor governments since Rudd and Gillard, 2007 to 2013, have recognised the need for school reform, but avoided structural reform and the politics it requires, preferring instead reform as technique, incremental steps toward targets in this or that aspect of schooling in search of a frictionless way around vested interests. Big problems have been converted into the counterfeit currency of outcomes. It hasn't worked, even in its own desiccated terms, and there is no reason to believe that it will. Unlike the Schools Commission in 1978, those who now direct reform can measure the waves, but don't understand that beneath the waves are currents. And also, unlike the Schools Commission in 1978, understanding is not what they're after. Dogs respond as follows. The current situation is exactly what Dogs predicted in 1964 when state aid started to trickle into private sectarian schools. After 1973, state aid became a flood. It now amounts to billions and even increasing billions of dollars, dividing our children along religious sectarian lines. Only the struggling public system brings them together. Dean Ashenden is right that politicians have preferred incremental steps in small targets in search of a frictionless way around vested interests. So perhaps you should go further and call a spade a spade. Who and what are those vested interests? Coalition parties have at least been honest. They have promoted and generously funded with taxpayer funds religious schools for a wealthy and powerful oligarchy under the catch cry of choice. But the Labor Party politicians, academics, and even some teacher unions have never had the intestinal fortitude to confront Dean Ashenden's vested interests. Dean Ashenden is weeping tears of frustration now, 50 years later. But where was he and academics like him when the Dogs took the private schools and churches to the High Court under Section 116 of the Constitution? They have never been prepared to be called anti-religion, anti-Catholic, or even anti-oligarchy. Even though promoters of equality of opportunity and public education are only promoting the most fundamental institution for a democracy, namely public education. Now back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. The Dogs were very interested to see how Mr. Dean Ashenden talks about the politicians in search of a frictionless way around vested interests. Don't you love it? Academic talk. But let's hear a bit more from Dean Ashenden, because his article is interesting because it gives you a very sad history, the history that Dogs knows all about, because we've been there all the time saying, call a spade and take on the religious interests and let's separate the religion from the state. But none of the academics like Dean Ashenden have had the intestinal fortitude to do it. So let's hear from Mr. Dean Ashenden, his view of the history of the last 50, 60 years.
Thanks, Jane. And here's the article that was mentioned in the press release. How to Disappear a Problem. The school system has spent 50 years not fixing one of its central flaws. And this was written by Dean Ashenden and published in Inside Story on the 10th of July. Early in 1973, the Carmel Committee, created by the new and aggressively reformist Whitlam government, was hard at work devising a way for all schools, including Catholic parish schools and a handful of upmarket private schools, to get public funding. Government schools had towered over the whole system for 80 years or more, and no wonder. They were fully funded, while the Catholics and the privates had been cut off without a public penny by the free, compulsory, and secular movement of the late 19th century. Writing to Whitlam's instructions, Carmel was about to turn the tables. The non-government schools could look forward to public bounty. The committee did as it was required to do, but was less than happy about it, and said so in carefully modulated tones. There is a point beyond which it is not possible to consider policies relating to the private sector, it warned, without taking into account their possible effects on the public sector, whose strength and representativeness should not be diluted. The problem anticipated soon materialised and grew. It has been a recurring theme in schools' talk ever since, without anyone actually doing anything about it. A few moments from an instructive story. 1978. In one of its formidable reports, the School Commission, the Carmel Committee's successor, worried about how public policy might cause government schools to become residual. Many of those who favour choice as a prime policy objective assume that the choice being spoken of is only that traditionally available between government and non-government schools, it said. If this is so, and as public funds now sustain this choice, important questions arise about conditions of entry to non-government schools, about the cost to parents of exercising such choice, about the extent to which the governance and operation of the schools should be publicly regulated as public subsidies rise, and about how and under what conditions new non-government schools should be permitted or assisted. There are also questions about the effect on government systems arising from making the choice to move out of them easier for parents. If such choice is greatly enhanced, government schools could become residual institutions, serving only those children whose parents were unwilling or unable to meet even low fee levels in non-government schools, or who were geographically isolated from or indifferent to or unaware of alternatives. 1984. The Australian Education Union picked up the residualisation idea and argued that the Schools Commission, now under new management, was making recommendations to government that would turn government schools into schools of last resort. 1998, government secondary school enrolments fell to 64%, down from 78% in 1975. Catholic schools, up from 15% to 22%, the independents doubled their share from 7% to 14%. The shift was so marked and so persistent, it now had a name, the drift. 2001. The Ministerial Council for Education, Employment, Training and Youth Affairs set up a school resourcing task force to develop a clear and common understanding of the premises upon which funding for schools should be based. Subsequent work commissioned by the Victorian government argued for muscling up. Non-government schools in receipt of substantial public funding should be required to take all comers from the local area with extra funding as appropriate. 2004. A Labor-dominated Senate inquiry on school funding accused the Howard government of ignoring the Ministerial Council's recommendations so it could continue to push funds towards non-government schools. Coalition senators, on the other hand, saw a government that supported parents' right to choose and committed to raising the national standard of school education through rigorous standards and tested attainments. 2010. Federal Education Minister and Deputy PM Julia Gillard announced the first review of schools funding in 40 years, a nod to Carmel, but with no mention of Carmel's warnings about the strength and representativeness of the government sector. The review would look at funding and funding only. It was in fact a review of only some aspects of funding. It took as given the existence of three sectors, government, Catholic and independent, and funding by two levels of government. 2012. The Gonski report was released to acclaim on all sides except the federal opposition and inexplicably now PM Gillard, who adopted a we'll have to see about the money position. A union-led grassroots campaign for Gonski's needs-based funding forced opposition leader Tony Abbott to declare a unity ticket on Gonski. The ticket was torn up within weeks of the coalition taking office. A decade of coalition government in Canberra would see most funding for the non-government sectors coming from the deep pockets of the Commonwealth, leaving the government schools to depend mainly on the chronically indigent states and territories. 2015. A small Melbourne-based group, of which I was a member, attempted a rethink of the problem. Our conclusions, funding meant all aspects of funding, including sources and limits. The regulation of choice and selection were as important as the funding. The problem wasn't just policy for the sectors, as Carmel had suggested, but the whole sector set up. Structural reform was called for. To level the playing field, the sectors should be moved toward common funding and regulatory regimes. Contrary to the implications of the residualisation analysis, fixing the government sector meant fixing the whole system. Papers were written, workshops held, a high-level round table convened, and small grants from a nervous foundation obtained. But in a coalition-dominated firmament, the idea got no traction. 2022. Two members of the Level Playing Fields project, Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner, pressed on. Their labours produced Waiting for Gonski, to excellent timing. The book's publication coincided with the end of the coalition decade and the arrival in Canberra of a sympathetic Labour government. In Greenwell and Bonner's definitive account of the sorry history of the sector system, Labour governments played an equivocal role, while coalition governments, going back to the Howard years, were ruthless in exploiting the weaknesses of the Whitlam-Carmel settlement. The upshot wasn't just the residualisation of government schools, it was a wholesale demographic shift. The disadvantaged were going to school with other disadvantaged kids, the advantaged to schools for the advantaged. Greenwell and Bonner sketched a proposal for level playing field that would reconcile choice and equity and suggested how it might be got. Their proposals were subsequently fleshed out and popularised in Choice and Fairness, a common framework for all Australian schools. Notice was taken, they succeeded in getting segregation onto the new government's agenda. Without diminishing these achievements, we must also note omissions. On the causes side of the equation, a real estate market that allowed the advantaged, but not others, to buy into the zone of a good government school. On consequences, Greenwell and Bonner worried mainly about segregation's impact on outcomes. Much more important is the impact on how young people, disadvantaged and advantaged, view themselves and others and see the proper working of the world, as well as its impact on the culture and the social order as a whole. Economics writer Ross Gittins summed it up. Jewish kids go to one school, Muslim kids go to another. Then he posed a riddle. What did the rich kid say to the poor kid? Answer, nothing. They never met. 2023. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare pointed to exceptionally high levels of social segregation in Australian schools, but then defined it as a problem only for the disadvantaged, and for them only to the extent that it affected outcomes. His expert panel, appointed to advise on the contents of the next National School Reform Agreement, reviewed the segregation question and recommended annual tracking and reporting of a socio-economic diversity before cutting the problem down to size in three swift strokes. First, it commissioned a consulting firm to report on policy responses used in other countries. There would be no analysis of Australia's unique sector system or policy in respect of it. Second, and following the minister, it construed segregation not as a problem for all students or for the wider society, but as a problem for the disadvantaged. And third, the one and only problem among disadvantaged students was unsatisfactory attainment in the basics. Thus advised, the school reform agreements made no mention of the problem of segregation by that or any other name. 2025. The Ramsay Foundation supported work by Dr. Michelle Brunige, a former head of the New South Wales and then Federal Departments of Education, on concentrations of disadvantage. It then commissioned essential research to develop a guide to framing and communicating that problem to the wider public. Essential's report has not been released, but it is believed to have stayed well within the concentrations of a disadvantaged construction of the problem. What should we make of this dismal tale? One common way of looking at it is that the system is resistant to reform. But perhaps it's incompetent reform that's the problem. The sector system and the machinery that has failed to reform it comprise two of the three structures that shape and drive Australian schooling. The third is the organisation of students' work. Labor governments since Rudd and Gillard, 2007-13, have recognised the need for school reform, but avoided structural reform and the politics it requires, preferring instead reform as technique. Incremental steps towards targets in this or that aspect of schooling in search of a frictionless way around vested interests. Big problems have been converted into the counterfeit currency of outcomes. It hasn't worked, even in its own desiccated terms, and there is no reason to believe that it will. Unlike the Schools Commission in 1978, those who now direct at reform can measure the waves but don't understand that beneath the waves are currents. And also, unlike the Schools Commission in 1978, understanding is not what they're after. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And I suppose it does the heart good that Dean Ashenden is concerned now that he has retired at what has happened in the last 50 years. But let's have a break, shall we?
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual. knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
RCR is radical radio.
Through our on-air content and community structure, we promote real change for workers' rights, gender equality, environmental action, disability justice, and on racism and First Nations sovereignty.
Do you want to be part of real radical change?
We need you to subscribe. It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Call 03-9419-8377. That's 9419-8377. Or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
We hope that you're still listening to the Jobs Program because Sol has got some more facts and figures for you from Trevor Cobold from Save Our Schools in Canberra. She's going to tell us about the richest Western Australian private schools that rake in nearly $50 million in non-fee income. Over to you, Sol.
Thanks, Jean. This article is by Trevor Cobold and is entitled 20 richest Western Australia private schools rake in nearly $50 million in non-fee income. New figures obtained from the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission show that 20 private schools serving the richest families in Western Australia raked in nearly $50 million in 2023 from donations, investment income, and other income. Shockingly, this money is ignored by governments in determining taxpayer funding of these schools. It is a fundamental flaw in how the Commonwealth Government funds rich, exclusive private schools. It means they are being overfunded compared to public and other private schools that do not have such privileged income streams. It is an inequity that must be ended. Financial statements and reports lodged with the Charities Commission show that 20 schools with a median adjusted taxable family income of over $200,000 a year received $46.5 million in 2023 from donations, investment income, and other income, such as from rental properties, hire of facilities, and sale of assets. They received $14.6 million in donations, $8.4 million as investment income, and $22.6 million in other income. Of the 20 schools, six received $31 million from these sources. These 20 schools got $218 million in government funding in 2023. The big winner was Christ Church Grammar. It raked in $8.1 million, including $2.9 million in donations and $5.3 million from investments. According to school family income data released to Senate estimates by the Department of Education, the median family income of Christ Church Grammar was the highest in the state at $376,000. The top 25% of families in the school earned over $690,000. Despite their privileged families and other income sources, the MySchool website shows that the school received $9.5 million in government funding in 2023, including $5.7 million from the Commonwealth and $3.8 million from the Western Australian government. Another big winner was St. Mary's Girls' School, which raked in $5.7 million, including $3 million in donations, $0.3 million from financial investments, and $2.4 million from other sources. The median family income was $276,000, with 25% of families having an income over $438,000. It received $11 million in government funding in 2023, including $7.9 million from the Commonwealth and $3 million from the Western Australian government. Four other schools received $4 million or more in non-fee income. St Hilda's Girls School received $4.8 million, Scotch College $4.4 million, All Saints College $4.2 million, and Hale School $4 million. The four schools received $38 million in government funding in 2023. They all had a median family income of over $250,000. In this context, it is worth noting that the family income measure is adjusted taxable income, which is generally far less than the total income of the wealthy, because they can take advantage of an array of tax concessions, such as negative gearing, capital gains discount, deductible donations, and gifts to reduce their taxable income. For example, Australian Tax Office statistics show that 188 millionaires had a taxable income of $18,200 or less in 2021 to 2022, and therefore paid no income tax. The donation stream for these schools is supported by multiple tax-exempt organisations, such as foundations, building funds, scholarship funds, library and funds or trusts which have deductible gift recipient status, or DGR status. Donations to these funds are tax-deductible for the donors. This is effectively another form of taxpayer subsidy for the schools, as they would receive fewer donations without DGR status. For example, Christ Church Rama has a foundation, building, library, and a scholarship and bursary fund with DGR status, according to the DGR register. The foundation had assets of $62 million in 2023. St Mary's Girls School has a foundation and building fund, and Scotch College has a building fund, a library fund, and a scholarship and bursary fund. Hale School has a foundation, building fund, and scholarship fund. School building and other DGR funds are largely the preserve of wealthy schools. A report by the Productivity Commission on Philanthropy showed that such funds are heavily concentrated in highly privileged schools. For example, 7 schools out of 719 schools, or 1% of schools with tax-deductible school building funds, received $24.6 million in donations in 2020 to 2021, which is 35% of all donations to building funds. Just 72 schools, or 10% of schools with such funds, received $58 million, representing 84% of all donations to building funds. In regard to schools with multiple funds, 72 schools out of 736, 10%, with such funds received $133 million in tax-deductible donations, which is 71% of all donations to such funds. Apart from receiving millions in donations and dividends from financial investments, some schools obtain substantial income from rental properties and hiring out facilities such as swimming pools and theatres. For example, All Saints College received $0.4 million from hire of its facilities in 2023. It is incredible that tax-exempt, commercially derived income of private schools is ignored in how taxpayer funding of private schools is determined. Rich private schools attract millions in tax-deductible donations to build luxurious facilities, which they are then able to hire out to earn income that is also disregarded in assessing their government funding entitlement. Only the rich benefit from this arrangement. Commonwealth government funding of private schools ignores all this non-fee income. It is based only on the capacity of families to pay fees, called the capacity to contribute, the CTC, which is measured by the adjustable taxable income of families as reported by the Australian Taxation Office. Disregard of donations, investment income, and other commercially sourced income is a major loophole in the private school funding system. It provides enormous benefits to rich families and wealthy schools who are best placed to take advantage of the loophole. The benefits are not available to any significant extent for public schools and less advantaged private schools. In summary, the loophole results in higher government funding for schools than if non-fee income were included in the Commonwealth government funding assessment. Moreover, government funding of these schools is boosted by the ability of rich families to take advantage of the tax-deductible status of building and other funds to reduce their taxable income. Such claims reduce the median adjusted taxable family income used to determine government funding. Schools also have incentives to maximise their income from financial investments, rental properties and hire of facilities, because this income is tax exempt. Wealthy schools are in the privileged position of being able to collect millions in donations to fund more luxurious facilities, which they can hire out to gain tax exempt income. All this because by some twisted logic, these schools are regarded as charities. These arrangements result in massive overfunding of wealthy private schools by the taxpayer. It is a huge waste of funds and simply adds to the huge resource advantage that exclusive private schools have over public schools. It reduces the amount of funds that would have a far greater impact if spent on schools educating children from disadvantaged backgrounds. One step towards a fairer funding method and eliminating the waste is to include non-fee income of private schools, especially that flowing to the richest schools, in determining their level of Commonwealth government funding. The Albanese government should commission the National School Resourcing Board to conduct an inquiry on including non-fee income in the funding model to ensure a fairer funding of private schools. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Sorrel. But coming back from Western Australia and the well-heeled parents and children over there, let's find out about how the Victorian teachers are fighting the good fight for the same pay and conditions as the New South Wales teachers up there in Albury. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is an Australian Education Union Victorian branch press release. Wodonga teachers call for the same pay and conditions as teachers in Albury. Victorian public school teachers, principals and education support staff from the Wodonga region are calling for the Allan Labor government to commit to a 35% pay increase and improved conditions in the next Victorian Government Schools Agreement, VGSA. The Australian Education Union Victorian branch has unveiled a stark comparison of teacher salaries between Victoria and New South Wales, with branch president Justin Mullaly saying low pay and public school funding cuts mean that the Allan government cannot rightfully call Victoria the education state. Local students are set up for success when their teachers, principals and education support staff are supported to stay in the profession, Mr. Mullaly said. Right now, Victorian's public schools are the lowest funded in the country and our teachers the lowest paid, with the education support staff and school leaders also undervalued. There is a huge disparity in public school salaries between Victoria and New South Wales. For example, next year, an experienced teacher living in Wodonga would be $15,359 better off a year or $295 a week by crossing the Murray and teaching in a public school in Albury. In 2026, an experienced Victorian teacher will be paid $118,063 compared to $133,422 for an experienced teacher in New South Wales. At the entry level, a Victorian teacher will be paid $79,589 compared to $92,882 in New South Wales. Entry-level pay for Victorian classroom-based education support staff is far too low compared to New South Wales, with a $6,000 or 10.5% gap. This also means that experienced education support staff are not paid what they are worth. Only 3 in 10 Victorian public school staff intend to stay working in public schools until retirement, and nearly 40% are uncertain about continuing to work in Victorian public schools. The Allan Labor government must get serious about addressing the workforce shortage in our public schools. That means decent pay and conditions to attract and retain our public school teachers, principals and education support staff, increased classroom supports and smaller class sizes, Mr. Mullaly said. The AEU log of claims for the next VGSA includes a 35% pay increase for all public school staff over the life of the agreement. Smaller class sizes so every student can have greater individual attention and support. Increased allied health and classroom support for students. Modern and flexible working arrangements. Significant improvements to working conditions, including workload reductions. The AEU received 716 school sub-branch submissions representing the views of tens of thousands of teachers, principals and education support staff to the union's log of claims process, and thousands of new members have joined the AEU since the beginning of the year. AEU members are highly engaged, ready to campaign for themselves and for the students they work with, Mr. Mullaly said. Public school teachers, principals and education support workers are dedicated, hard-working professionals. They require the state government to back them in with the same dedication. I'm back to you, Jean.
Thank you, Andy, but let's have another quick break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
We hope you're still listening to the dogs because we're going overseas now with Jeff, not only to America, but to India. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Interesting one today. We're going to start in the United States and then we're going to go to an interesting story from India. The first article we're going to talk about is from the ABC News, that's American Broadcasting Corporation, by Devin Dwyer. And it's from July 11th, 2025. And it's titled, Schools Brace for Wave of Parents Seeking Opt-Outs After Supreme Court Ruling. The article begins, when public school teachers return to classrooms this fall, they will confront a new legal landscape that has given parents expanded veto power over certain aspects of a child's education. A sweeping constitutional interpretation issued last month from the US Supreme Court recognises a fundamental right under the First Amendment to opt out from classroom lessons that may pose what it is called a very real threat of undermining sincerely held religious beliefs. It has school districts and attorneys nationwide scrambling to review curriculum for possible conflicts and fine-tune protocols for when and how students can be excused from certain material. It marks a significant challenge for public education nationwide. The Montgomery County, Maryland Board of Education, which lost the case, said in a statement on the decision. The board has been sued by a group of Muslim, Jewish and Christian parents after it refused to permit families to opt out their children from exposure to storybooks with LGBTQIA+ themes. The right of parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children would be an empty promise if it did not follow those children into the public school classroom, Justice Samuel Alito wrote in the majority opinion. The ruling effectively requires schools to notify parents in advance of any classroom concepts that might be contrary to a particular religion and to accommodate requests to provide alternative instruction. Sarah Parshall Perry, a former US Department of Education attorney and current vice president of the conservative advocacy group Defending Education, called it a clear directive to districts. In making the decision, the High Court expanded an earlier religious liberty in schools case, Wisconsin versus Yoda. Perry wrote in a blog post, in that 1972 decision, the court held that Amish families could opt their children out of compulsory education past the eighth grade because continuing in school longer would be a violation of their religious beliefs. While religious rights advocates hailed the ruling as common sense, some civil rights groups, educators and parents fear it now undermines the very foundation of public education. This decision could have a chilling effect, says Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, the nation's largest union of public school teachers, and it could lead to more educators self-censoring, shelving books and lessons, and preventing some already marginalised students from being seen and acknowledged. Some school officials have privately worried about a Pandora's box of administrative burdens that sweeping opt-out rights now present, and said they may consider preemptively removing content from the curriculum entirely in order to avoid confrontations with parents. I'm sure there will be more parents that are going to exercise this right, said Jim Walsh, a Texas lawyer who represents school boards and is a member of the National Schools Attorneys Association. Federal courts have already fielded numerous disputes in recent years over religious objections to classroom lessons, including faith-based opposition to teaching women's empowerment, the theory of evolution, co-educational physical education, and celebration of Halloween. There are religions that oppose medical science, surgery, psychiatry, interracial marriage, monogamy, women's suffrage, the right of gay people to marry, and so on, said Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat, and attorney and law professor. All of them will now be able to flood the courts with claims that particular curricular teachings and books offend their sincere values and their children should not be exposed to the offensive doctrines. To evaluate the claims, frontline educators could be put in a tough spot. School administrators will have to become experts in a wide range of religious doctrines in order to predict in advance whether a parent may object to a particular text, lesson plan or school activity as contrary to their religious beliefs, wrote Justice Sonia Sotomayor in her dissent in the case. The result will be chaos. Walsh offered a more sanguine appraisal based on the experience of Texas, which has had an expansive statewide opt-out available to parents for 30 years. Parents can opt out of anything they have a religious or moral objection to, and the school has to accommodate that. It has not caused significant problems, Walsh said. One reason the impact has been muted, he said, is that kids are frequently embarrassed when their parents do this. As for concerns that schools might self-censor material so as to avoid conflict with parents, Walsh said it's a likely possibility. Sotomayor predicts a lot of litigation. I think she's probably right about that, but I think if districts adopt a policy and transparency and allow opt-out with some limitations on that, I think that's going to go a long way for reducing that. That's the end of the article. But this is the new intrusion caused by the takeover of Project 2025 of the American education system, the destruction of public education or the religious intrusions into what public education survives, that's just the beginning of what's going on in the States. And it's religious intrusion into classrooms by the right wing that we're going to explore in India. So in India, we might just mention a couple of things to preempt the article. One is that the Vedic knowledge, which is the basis of the Hindu religion, is a series of texts and books going back 1500 BC or so through to about 500 AD. Guru Puja, according to the Art of Living org, is a traditional ceremony of gratitude honouring the lineage of spiritual masters who have been the custodians of knowledge of the self. In other words, it's the practice of honouring the guru. It's a ceremony which involves putting flowers at the feet of the guru, or washing the feet of the guru, things like that, which recognises the spiritual leadership of the guru in matters relating to religion. Now, the other thing I'm going to just mention before reading the article is the right-wing group founded in 1925 called Rashtriya, forgive the pronunciation here, Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, which is the RSS. The RSS is a right-wing group, which is a Hindu nationalist group, which started in 1925 in India. It represents itself as a cultural, not a political organisation, according to Britannica, that nevertheless advocates a Hindu nationalist agenda under the banner of Hindutva, or Hinduness. The group is structured hierarchically under the guidance of a national leader, while regional leaders are charged with overseeing local branches. So it's a far right religious right group in India, and is very much into defending Hinduism. So in there's a controversy which has come to the fore in Kerala, and this article comes from India Today. And it's written by Prija Aravind from the July 14th, 2025. And it's involving the intrusion of religion into state schools and the support of that by the RSS, the right-wing religious group, religious nationalists, Hindu nationalists. So the article begins. Kerala Governor. State spa again, this time over feet-washing ritual in schools. A fresh row has erupted between Kerala Governor Rajendra Alekar and the state government after visuals emerged of students washing teachers' feet during Guru Purnima celebrations. While Education Minister Sivan Kudi criticised it, the governor defended the ritual. The Kerala government raised concerns about the appropriateness of students washing the feet of teachers in educational settings after videos of the same during Guru Purnima celebration. The controversy erupted after videos showing students washing the feet of teachers in some CBSE schools went viral. In one instance, at a school in Alappuzha, a BJP district secretary, Anoop, was also among those whose feet were washed as part of the ceremony. Following this, Kerala Education Minister V. Sivan Kudi sought an explanation from the schools involved. However, Governor Rajendra Vishwanath Alekar defended the observance of ritual in schools as the practice of Guru Puja. Speaking at the public event, Governor Alekar strongly defended the ritual. Guru Puja is our culture, and in that culture we offer flowers at the feet of our guru. And some people have objected to it. I don't understand from which culture they are coming from. What are their thoughts? He further recounted a complaint that he received from a religious leader about the police coming to a school run by his institution in Kasaragod and asking about the Guru Puja celebration in the city. He said, "What should we tell them? What do they mean by why perform? It is our culture, the culture of our country, our soil. what answer can be given. Governor Arlecker also questioned the rationale behind criticising the practice and said if one tries to forget their culture, they will forget themselves and will be nowhere in this world. Education Minister V. Sivankutty rejected the governor's stance, saying they are making our small children wash their feet. I don't even know where in Indian culture is something like this said. There are many books related to Indian culture. Does any of it say that students should be used to wash the feet of BJP leaders? Does any of it say that this is Kerala culture? It doesn't say anywhere. It's the agenda of RSS which is coming out through the governor, the minister further stated. Sivankutty also asserted that Kerala does not follow such a culture and has expressed concern over using children for such practices in educational settings. The state government has also asked the managements of the schools concerned to explain the circumstances under which the ritual was conducted. And that ends the article. But it's just another example that shows that the rise of the right-wing religious groups around the world, whatever culture, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, all the minor ones, we'll say minor, the major if you're in that, involved in it, they seem to be pushing their intrusions into the classroom. And this is why we need to separate the idea of the state and religion. And this is why we believe that religion should not be involved in schools at all. The defenders of government schools firmly believe this. And this example from India is just another brick in the wall where these things are intruding. Anyway, with those two stories, we're going to pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and sign off. Keep chin up and talk to you next week. Cheerio.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And now we come to the best time when we can be positive. There's a marvellous annual conference speech by the president of the New South Wales Teachers Federation, which I think we should all hear. We get a bit down because we've been fighting the good fight for a long time, and they have too, but there have been some wins. After all, Mr. Dutton and Mr. Abbott didn't get back into Parliament after all. So let's hear from the president of the New South Wales Teachers Federation, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. And this is from the New South Wales Teachers Federation Annual Conference 2025, Year in Review, from the President. The Federation's three-day annual conference began in the International Conference Centre at Darling Harbour on the 6th of July, including a celebration of the work and achievements of the past 12 months. President Henry Rajendra's speech, the annual report and a video acknowledged keeping the coalition out of power at the May federal election, the Albanese government's commitment to lifting federal funding from 20 to 25% of the schooling resource standard through the efforts of our union, we got both state and federal governments to agree to something that was never on the table this time last year, Mr. Rajendra said. Not only did we convince the Albanese government to increase their proposed SRS funding contribution from 2.5 to 5%, but also dealt with the New South Wales government's artificial accounting tricks. The reversal of privatisation of vocational education policy, the removal of TAFE New South Wales from the contestable vocational education and training funding market, an additional 100,000 free TAFE places each year until 2027, a three-year schools award including competitive salaries, additional school development days, an end to twilight professional learning sessions, a one-hour cap on total meeting time before and or after schools per week, new flexible work arrangements for family, work and care responsibilities, enhancements to family and domestic violence leave, an additional entitlement for special fertility leave, the right to disconnect from digital communications, a three-year TAFE enterprise agreement, including cumulative pay rises of 9.8% by February 2027, and better conditions for casuals, including a guaranteed offer of permanent employment after 6 months. The significant improvements are necessary to support and retain the teachers in our system, allowing a better balance of their family, work and care responsibilities, Mr. Rajendra said. Back to you, Jean.
Well, that does the heart good. And here's something else to lift up your spirits. We'd like to tell you about our great state school of the week. And here is Andy Libbitt.
Every week on the Dogs Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's Great State School of the Week is Williamstown High School. Williamstown High School is a multi-campus school with two quite unique and complementary campuses. Our Bayview campus, catering for years 7 to 9 students, was built on environmentally sustainable principles, and its focus is to ensure students successfully transition from primary school and are quickly engaged by a range of diverse, challenging and inclusive activities. Our Pasco campus, catering for our year 10 to 12 students, is housed in heritage-listed buildings which provide a long and rich history. Here, our students have access to a range of year 10 electives, VCE, VET and VCAL certificates that allows each individual the opportunity to create a three-year program that will see them well prepared for success in whatever pathway they wish to pursue. Both campuses provide an outstanding learning environment that is both inspiring and nurturing. Our focus on individual growth and success, together with our emphasis on support and connection, encourages students to live out our motto: we are safe, we are respectful, we are learners. Our students are provided with many opportunities to excel. These include general academic excellence, sport, visual and performing arts, debating, leadership, environmental issues, and a strong instrumental music program. There are numerous ways in which students may showcase their talents to both the local and broader school community, and these events also serve the purpose of bringing the school community together to celebrate our students' achievements. Our school-wide positive behaviour support, SWPBS framework, aims to create and maintain a positive and safe learning environment that enhances our school culture, where we maximise individual academic and social growth. Our values, listed below, strongly influence our pursuit of a dynamic learning culture that promotes integrity, innovation, and the individual. Excellence and creativity in our achievements and ambitions. Integrity and honesty in our actions and relationships. Diversity in our curriculum, in each other, and in our community. Strong and open communication between our school and our homes, and between our teachers, students, and our families. A commitment to social justice and a passion to protect and improve our environment and our community. We enjoy a strong sense of community, working together to develop a supportive and strong three-way partnership between home, students and school. We believe strongly that high expectations will empower students to be responsible for their own learning. Our outstanding academic results and focus on the development of the whole person makes Williamstown High School the school of choice for many families, both within and beyond the surrounding suburbs. Our students are on an extraordinary journey. They arrive excitedly on the first day of school and leave proud and prepared for the challenges that lie ahead on their last. The school's rich history, the achievements of the present, and anticipation for the future inspires every day of our work, and I am proud to be principal of Williamstown High School and to lead this team. We are all privileged to be able to observe and participate in this journey. And that's from Gino Catalano, the principal of Williamstown High School. Current enrolments, 1513. And the ICSEA value is above average at 1,110. Representative of a diverse urban community. Upper 25% of parental income accounts for 46% of students. The second quartile of parental income, 29% of students. The third quartile, below 50% of average income, is 16% of students, and 8% are in the lowest quartile of family incomes, with 22% speaking a language other than English and 1% Indigenous students. The finances: recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $4.8 million and $17.7 million from the Victorian Government. Fees and parental contributions add another $1.8 million and other private contributions, $350,000. And that works out at $16,587 per pupil. And back to you, Jean.
Congratulations to the Williamstown High School and congratulations to the Dogs. We not only got to our limit for the radiothon, we got well over it. We were asked to raise $4,500 and we raised $5,515, I think it was. So congratulations to all of those people who prepared to dig very deep to give us our target. But our time has gone, and it's up to me to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and our offsider, Andy, together with Sol and Jeff, of course. And if you wish to find out more about us, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at 3CR and from the dogs, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.